I wonder if you've had that experience of mixed feelings. You know, perhaps it was the combination of nervousness and confidence before an exam or a driving test. Maybe it was that excitement and fear that you feel when you're about to become a new parent. Perhaps as we head into Christmas, you're feeling sort of both the sense of anticipation and joy of celebrating with family and friends and church, but you know, you're also kind of over it, right? There are times when we humans feel two ways about the same thing, and we can oscillate quite easily from one feeling to another. And in our passage today, we have two Son of Man statements from Jesus. We're looking in our series at Jesus talking about himself as the Son of Man. And both of these statements come in discussions between Jesus and his disciples. And they come as they are making their way toward Jerusalem via Jericho. They both kind of belong together in this same sort of scene. But there's a striking contrast between the sort of two subsections of the passage. The contrast is in the attitude of the disciples. First, have a look at verse 32. Because what we see there are disciples who are astonished and people who are following who are afraid. With Jesus out in front leading the way and apparently these other guys kind of lagging behind. But then cast your eyes down to verse 35 where James and John are bold enough to ask Jesus for prominent positions. And then in verse 39 they express his willingness to endure what Jesus will endure. And then all the others kind of get angry about these guys making this request. So there's first this astonishment mixed with fear and then this kind of boldness, arrogance kind of thing going on. So let's have a look at this ambivalence and see if we can work it out. Let's start with the astonishment and fear part. Because it's worth noting that the 12 disciples maybe were less fearful and just more shocked. As in, there's the kind of close disciples who are shocked and there's a bigger group of people who are afraid. But in any case, why would anyone be feeling like this? We know from what we've looked at over the last few weeks that Jesus presented himself as this person he called the Son of Man. He's shown himself to have this God-like authority. Mark showed us that in Jesus forgiving the sins of a paralyzed man and then backing that up by healing the man. We saw it too when Jesus put himself on the same level as Israel's old king, King David. He assumed the authority to interpret how God's law should be enacted by his people. And he even declared himself alongside with God to be Lord of the Sabbath. So Jesus has talked about how he's the Son of Man with all earthly authority. But once his close disciples started to understand that, once they recognized him as the Messiah, Jesus started talking about what would happen to him. He made these predictions again and again. He would be rejected and suffer, be killed and rise again. It's this constant refrain through Mark's story. He's actually had it already kind of three times talked about this thing. And the way Mark writes those up, you get the impression that Jesus was saying this regularly to his disciples. And if you remember last week, you might know that the teachers of the law, part of the Pharisee group, those guys wanted to kill Jesus. And the Herodians, who were supporters of Herod, the Jewish Roman sort of conspirator king, they also wanted to bring Jesus down. And now they're on their way to Jerusalem. This is the place where political tensions run high, where the elders, the chief priests and the teachers of the law have most control. And so it's kind of shocking that Jesus should just walk into this place. It's scary to think what might happen to those who follow with him. Though many fear, Jesus maintains the same message. They might be shocked, but Jesus takes his special 12 disciples, his leadership group, and he comes back to tell them what's going to happen. Now, in introducing this saying, the narrator underscores that Jesus is talking about himself as the Son of Man. These are the things that will happen to him. Jesus also uses the first person plural. He says, we are going up to Jerusalem, which points to a personal involvement in this situation. It also has some serious implications for the disciples as well. that Jesus is talking about himself. And the reason I keep stressing that, you might have noticed that sort of over the last few weeks, I keep saying Jesus is talking about himself as the Son of Man. The reason I'm saying that is because there are some scholars, some religious teachers as well, who think that Jesus was talking about someone else, that he was creating an expectation of another Son of Man to come. No, Jesus is talking about himself. That can't possibly be the case here. He's speaking about what's going to happen to him. And Jesus doesn't tell the disciples what he suspects might happen. He tells them what will happen. Jesus wanted them to be sure. Mark wants us to be sure. Jesus goes to Jerusalem knowing what's going to happen to him when he gets there. He sees it as a divine necessity. This is what he needs to do. And this is now the fourth time that Mark tells us this kind of information. Let's have a look at verse 33. They're going up to Jerusalem, and then after they get there, these events will take place. First, the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. Those who want to kill Jesus will get their chance. What will they do to him? What will they do to him? Jesus says they will condemn him to death. They will hand him over to the Gentiles. Now, the word Gentile simply means non-Jew. This means that the Jewish leadership is going to hand one of their own over to the oppressive Roman occupiers. And what will they do? They'll hand him over to the Gentiles, verse 34, who will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. Now, as I said, Jesus has spoken before about the Son of Man's rejection, his intense suffering and being killed, but now it's given a lot more detail. Maybe these 12 disciples should actually be a lot more scared than they are. As was the case in Jesus' previous prediction, his death is followed by resurrection on the third day. Now, resurrection is just a word that means to get up. So this morning, I resurrected from my bed when my alarm went off. When you're sick and you recover, you could speak of that as a resurrection. We also know that there are people who kind of die and come back to life. That is, their hearts stop or their brains stop, and somehow through medicine or miracle, a person revives. Having just talked about being killed, Jesus is talking about something like that last one. But it's far more astounding than the stories we might be familiar with. Because for starters, this is not 5 minutes on an operating table. This is not even a day on life support with no measurable brain activity. Jesus is talking about coming back to life after being killed by Roman soldiers. These guys knew how to kill people. They were quite good at it. They built an empire around doing it. Jesus is talking about coming back on a Sunday after being put in a grave on a Friday. But it's far bigger than that too. For while people at the time could not have fully understood it, Jesus was not talking about kind of going into death and coming back out for a time, only to die again. No, he was speaking about being the first of what the Old Testament had expected, this kind of resurrection age. For the Jewish people believed that there would be a time when all the dead would rise, and some would come into everlasting life in God's kingdom, and some would go into condemnation. And so Jesus is promising to be the first of that latter group to have a positive resurrection from death. One that doesn't just sort of go into death and come back out again, but one that goes and breaks through death completely. And so Jesus gives this private word to his disciples, confirming and expanding on what they've heard him say before. But they keep going on their way toward Jerusalem via Jericho, and suddenly that ambivalence switch is flicked. It says, verse 35, then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. Very subtle way of asking for something, isn't it? Jesus, of course, asked, verse 36, what do you want me to do for you? They replied, let one of us sit at your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. If Jesus was a prime minister forming a cabinet, they're asking for the important portfolios. They want to be treasurer and foreign minister. Verse 38, "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said. "Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" This is symbolic language. Jesus is saying, can you go through what I'm going to go through? Can you endure what I endure? It's both kind of positive and also kind of ominous. You know, the benefits of enjoying the feast, drinking the cup, but also drinking the cup, the bitter cup, the difficulties that I'm going to have to face. Verse 39, "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared." Jesus is not enacting his own personal plan. He's acting according to God's plan. He knows what will happen to him, and he will willingly choose to enact God's plan, but he's not permitted to change it. And what's incredible, as you read through Mark's story and you see Jesus enact the plan that he's just spoken of, there will be one on his right and on his left when he comes into his kingdom, when he enacts the plans he's laid out. And who is it? After he's beaten and spat on and mocked and put to death, it's not his disciples who are on his right and left. No, his friends abandon him, and Jesus is put up on the cross with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. In any case, James and John would, in very far down the track, endure the same sufferings, serious sufferings, that Jesus did. But their power play at this point didn't come off at all, did it? And they will actually, as the story progresses, they will fail to do what Jesus has asked them to do. And to make matters worse, now the rest of the group finds out about this conversation that they've had with Jesus. Look at verse 41. "When the ten heard about this, they became indignant with James and John." And you would, wouldn't you? After all, these guys have tried to go and get one up on you. They tried to sort of sneak in around it and promote themselves. This is kind of Canberra politics, isn't it? I wonder if maybe they're angry that they hadn't thought to ask before they did. Jesus calls the 12 disciples together and he addresses this whole situation. He's not going to have this among his group. He says, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." That's the normal way of our world, isn't it? People want to climb the ladder. They want to throw their weight around. Verse 43, "Not so with you." This has no place among Jesus' disciples. "Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must become your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." This not only excludes the normal way of the world, he inverts it entirely. Greatness is determined by servanthood, preeminence by slavery. Why should this be the rule for Jesus' followers? Why is this what the followers of Jesus, what the disciples of Jesus need to do? Verse 45 gives the answer. This is the explanation. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." This pattern of behaviour is expected of the disciples. They are not being asked to do anything different to what he has done. Voluntary, self-effacing service. But it's striking what Jesus does. Look at what it says. He gives his life as a ransom for many. Jesus, the Son of Man, would give this transactional, sacrificial offering of his life. See, Jesus must be talking about his death. He gives his life. And we just read about his prediction of his death and resurrection. He's just been solemnly speaking about this baptism and cup that he has to endure. The language of giving in the Bible is actually often used in reference to sacrifice, especially when it's used in conjunction with some sort of temple service or death. And the idea of a ransom for many, well, that evokes the slave trade, where people would be bought and sold. And so as one commentator puts it, Jesus sells himself into slavery in order to liberate his brothers and sisters from bondage. Jesus dies so that others might be free. This is what he came to do. This is his mission. And Jesus now, for the first time, is not just saying that the Son of Man is going to suffer and die and then rise. He's not just saying that the Son of Man needs to do that because it's God's plan, it's according to the Scriptures. Now he's saying what it's going to achieve. It's a sacrifice, it's a release payment for many. Our Old Testament reading was from the book of Isaiah, and Jesus probably had that passage and some others in mind as he said these words. Because in that passage from Isaiah, the themes of sacrifice and service, of acting according, of acting for many according to God's plans, that has clear parallels. And so while not directly quoting or translating Isaiah, I think that Jesus is offering a kind of summary of the task of the servant in that song, in that poem of Isaiah. And he's saying the Son of Man fulfills that through his death. Here's the mission. Rejected, then risen. And it's a payment, a sacrifice for many. So what do we learn about Jesus, the Son of Man, here? Well, Mark's story has Jesus repeatedly telling his disciples, the Son of Man, by which he's talking about himself, will suffer and die and rise again on the third day. This final prediction confirms those elements already seen in one form or another. The idea of handing over the betrayal, the condemnation by the Jewish authorities, but also adds in this key information, the location of Jerusalem, the role of the Gentiles in carrying out this condemnation, the specifics of what the Son of Man will endure. And so Jesus strides on ahead towards his destiny in Jerusalem. And Mark's gospel is preparing the readers, us as we read through the story, for what's about to take place, for the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's building suspense, but it's also focusing our attention. It's alerting us to what to expect. The disciples also have their shock and their fear addressed through this prediction of death and resurrection. Because the scourge and the crucifixion will not be a tragedy. It will fulfill God's plan. The passive endurance of the Son of Man is followed by his active resurrection. Jesus previously spoke of the Son of Man's death as necessary and in line with expectation of what is written, but now for the first time we have an interpretation of it. Jesus draws on Isaiah's suffering servant and makes that his mission. And so into the ambivalence of shock and fear on the one hand and boldness and power hungriness on the other, Jesus speaks. And this first saying offers a direct statement against their negative expectations. He will rise again. And just as Jesus has said that those who are going to follow him must kind of share in what he's doing, they must be baptized into what he's done, they must drink his cup, they must be like him if they're going to share in that goodness with him. It addresses both sides of this ambivalence. The Son of Man inverts the way that the disciples are thinking about things. It undermines their fear and it undermines their boldness. The Son of Man uses his immense authority to serve sacrificially. And so there's two big questions for us. Question one, have you been served by Jesus? And two, will you serve like Jesus? The first is far more important because the Son of Man has all earthly authority and he came to serve you. And if he says he's going to serve you, then it's your duty to let him. And his service cost him his life, so don't write that off. And he did it to guarantee your benefit. He sets you free. He offers a sacrifice on your behalf. Sacrifices are all about finding forgiveness and cleansing when you know yourself to be a moral failure and dirty. Ransoms are all about gaining freedom when you are trapped. It's about having debts repaid. Trapped by our moral failings in a world that's headed towards death, Jesus, the Son of Man with all earthly authority, steps in and he says, I'll swap, I'll serve, I'll save, I'll slave. This was the mission of the Son of Man. He has all earthly authority and he uses it to serve as a slave, to die as a criminal. And then he rises to new life. Earthly authority rejected and risen. Why? For us. Have you been served by Jesus? Don't leave church today without having a clear answer to that question. For it is vital. Have you been served by Jesus? And the second question can only be answered in the light of the first. It can only come after the first. Will you serve like Jesus served? It's a huge task to live as he lived, to love as he loved. And without having a clear answer, yes, to the first question, you will never be able to do it. Why? Because you'll either be motivated by fear or arrogance. It's either too big a task, it's too difficult, it's too hard, and you'll give up, you'll lag behind, you won't be able to do it. You'll see how much it costs and you'll shrink back. Or you'll make some progress at serving others and you'll think, yeah, you know, I'm doing well, certainly better than others. Maybe I'm not going to be the foreign minister or the treasurer, but I'll at least get a junior portfolio. But if you've answered a definitive yes to having been served by Jesus, there's no need to fear, for the rejected one, the one who lost, the one who died, rose again. There's no need to fear because all of the risk has been taken away. And if you say yes to having been served by Jesus, then you've admitted you needed him. You've admitted your dependence upon him. You know it's only by the free gift of himself that you can ever stand, let alone serve. You're a sinner and a slave. And he alone brought sacrifice and ransom. That's going to knock the boldness and arrogance right out of you when you admit that. When you say yes to having Jesus serve you. This is a huge thing that Jesus has done. It's so common in our world for people to be ambitious for recognition. We care so much about our reputation and being respected. And people will push each other down to climb the ladder. We'll make comparisons of ourselves to others to justify ourselves. Or we'll make comparison of ourselves to others and think, I could never be like that person. We all have our little ways, our systems for sort of point scoring. Maybe I don't think that's just me. I think everyone does that, right? But when we answer yes to being served by Jesus, that's not who we are anymore. Because Jesus has served us. The Son of Man, the one with all earthly authority, has slaved for us. And so we don't have any fear. We don't have any fear in comparison to other people. We don't have any fear of what others might do to us. And so now we can do the same for each other. And let me say, it starts here. It starts with us, our church, our brothers and sisters in Christ Jesus, serving and caring as he did. And when that really grips us, when it grips our hearts and our lives, what Jesus has done for us, it is so revolutionary. It's so inverting in the ways of this world. And it will do to us what it has done time and time again throughout history. it will transform us and it will radiate out into our world. And far, far more importantly, it will honour God and be honoured by Him. And so as you see the rejected and risen Jesus, will you let Him serve you? And then, and only then, and by the power of that, will you serve like He did? Let me pray for us. Gracious Lord Jesus, You are the one who died and rose again. Give us clarity about who You are. Fix in our minds what You have done for us. And help us to live in the strength of what You have done. To love and serve one another by the power of Your Spirit, for the sake of Your kingdom.